Can you do? This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight, returning, is Phil Freeman, a music journalist specializing in jazz and metal. And we're continuing our conversation about his book, Ugly Beauty, Jazz in the 21st Century. Phil, welcome back to the show. I had to continue our conversation about this book. It's a great collection of essays.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It's a challenging group of essays, too, and I want to say that for the benefit of people who are listening. This gets, at several points, this tries to get at the heart of what is it that we call jazz anymore? Does it even make any sense? What is the relevance of traditional jazz in 2020? And one of the things that you mentioned, and we'll start here. Frank Hogan talks about the concept of a super word, and you applied that to jazz. Talk about that.
Yeah, when I read that Frank Hogan thing, which I read online, I don't remember the original context for it, but I read it online somewhere, and he's talking about super words. And, his examples were punk and metal, and because you can argue, oh, that band's not punk,
Yeah, 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 yeah.
If you're a metal fan, as I am.
Oh, those arguments happen all the time. Yeah.
That's not metal, whatever. And so I said in my head, a bell went off, and I was like, jazz is very much a super word in that sense, because... And one of the things that I say in the book is you can tell that it's a word that means more than it ever was meant to mean just by the fact that it's been adjectivized in the sense that you can describe something as jazzy. The minute something becomes an adjective, it means more than itself,
It also means that you probably can't clearly define it.
Exactly. And that, if anything, one of the things that I think about, sometimes is what constitutes art at all.
Yeah.
And my ultimate verdict on that, I think, is anything made with artistic intent counts as art. Doesn't mean it's good art, just means it's art.
Well, that's like Andy Warhol's Brillo boxes. As a matter of fact, there's an entire book dedicated to why is that art when he just duplicated a Brillo box. And it all gets down to intent.
Yeah, exactly. And that may be really unsatisfying for some people, but to me, it just says that, it's up to, if the artist says it's art, then you have to at least honor their intention, if nothing else. You can still say it's terrible art, but you have to at least say, okay, they tried.
But, I would add that you can certainly say it's terrible art, but I want to know why you think it's terrible art. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I run into this all the time. Oh, that's horrible. But there's no explanation about why you think it's horrible. I need you to tell me why you think it's horrible. And then that reveals a lot about how you define things.
Yes, very much so.
You also write, and I love this too, jazz is nothing but a marketing term like hip hop.
Yeah, yeah. It in many ways it is a marketing term. I mean, look at jazz at Lincoln Center is all about the marketing of a certain type of jazz and a certain sort of attitude towards life that is filtered through that version of jazz. And it's very interesting. Years ago, in the 50s, I believe it was, somebody wrote about the New Yorker that they don't necessarily teach you anything. When you read an article about a subject in the New Yorker, you are not only absorbing information about that subject, you are also absorbing the attitude that the New Yorker editors expect you to take about the subject.
Huh.
And I feel like that's true of of an organization like Jazz at Lincoln Center as well. They want you to appreciate jazz in one of these three or four ways,
Exactly. They're defining how you listen to the music.
Right. And they're also, in a weird way, defining what kind of person you are if you listen to the music.
Huh. You're right.
And that's the part that I think is really interesting, is the aspirational lifestyle aspect of it. You know, and which
it becomes which like alcohol. It becomes like a booze ad in Playboy magazine in the 60s.
Right. Exactly. And it's funny because it's funny you say that, because in the mid 80s, Henry Threadgill, who is one of the great avant-garde jazz composers, won a Pulitzer recently. In the mid 80s, Henry Threadgill appeared in an ad for some brand of liquor, and I forget which it was, but the ad pops up on, you know, jazz Twitter every once in a while, and everybody thinks it's hilarious. But there is a certain aspirational lifestyle element. I was reading an essay this weekend where an author made, the author's name is Francis Gooding, and he made a really fascinating argument that smooth jazz is in fact a very radical form of black art, and that because it's aspirational, you know, it's intentionally sort of upper middle class, but it's music of the black community talking to itself. And the reason critics don't like it, in this guy's estimation, is because they prefer a kind of pathologized view of the black community where, you know, the screaming free jazz tenor sax is the voice of authenticity, the voice of upper middle class comfort is not the message they want to be sending. And I thought that it was a really fascinating way of interpreting those things. But again, jazz as, you know, if you accept jazz as a lifestyle sort of music, you have to make room for all sorts of different lifestyles.
That's right.
And so maybe this guy had a point. You know, I mean, there are Grover Washington Jr. albums that I think are fantastic. Now, am I going to go listen to, like, Najee or somebody? No. But, you know, I can accept the argument.
I accept the argument, you know, too. I totally get that. And by the way, the black aspect of jazz music comes up several times in the essays in your book. There's a concern whether some of these artists have traveled too far from the jazz vernacular, or are they black enough? That's a question that you bring up, and the history of being black in America is incredibly important for so many of these artists.
Yeah. Jeremy Pelt recently has started self-publishing books of interviews with artists, with other jazz musicians. And he's very much he states explicitly that this is about passing knowledge from one generation of black artists to the next. And, you know, and I mean, when I interviewed he's not in this book because he's from a different generation and doing different things. But when I spoke with Anthony Braxton, he was very vocal about the fact that for decades he was told that he was not black enough because of the music that he made, like orchestral music and, you know, writing a piece for 100 tuba players and all sorts of, you know, whatever ideas he had, he wanted to pursue them without having to think about whether he was black enough, you know?
Can we talk about Anthony Braxton for a moment? Because for many of these artists, and I think of people like Mary Halverson and others, Braxton is a key figure in their development as a jazz artist. Can you just talk about who he was, and then why he was so influential on contemporary jazz musicians?
Well, he started out, and he's still around, still making music. He started out in the AACM in Chicago, started making his own records in the 1960s, and in the 1970s got a big career boost by being signed to Arista. So they tried to make him somewhat mainstream, and, you know, it didn't take because his music is highly individual, you know, some of it's extremely brainy and verges on modern classical, and other stuff is, you know, much more conventionally jazz oriented, like in the sense that you could play it for anyone and they would say, yes, that's a jazz record. But For decades, he was a professor. And so he, particularly in the 90s and the 2000s, he began putting ensembles together that featured some of his promising students. And so that included Mary Halverson, Taylor Ho Bynum,
yep.
and a bunch of other, you know, a bunch of other people who have subsequently become prominent voices in the avant-garde on their own. And so obviously they owe a massive debt to him, not necessarily stylistic, because, you know, he always encourages people to go their own way and to do their own thing. So it's not like you would hear people, you wouldn't hear them making music that sounded overtly Braxtonian. Although Mary did actually record an entire album of his compositions mm-hmm. with her group Thumbscrew. But it was mostly compositions that he himself had not recorded. It was stuff off the shelf rather than, you know, best, you know, sort of like greatest hits or whatever. So at any rate, he's been hugely influential as someone who promotes not only his own work, but kind of a mindset and an approach to creativity. Tyshawn Sorey is another one
right.
who's hugely influenced by him. He talks about that, you know, or I quote him talking about that in the book. Particularly, he was the thing he took away from Braxton was basically the impulse to just go for it. Whatever idea you've got, do it and get it out there. You know, because, I mean, when I interviewed Braxton, I said, you know, I asked him if, because he's got hundreds of records,
yeah.
has written thousands of pieces, you know, stuff like this. So I said, if you have someone come to one of your shows who only likes one of your compositions from one album and they leave, you know, and they're into that, is that enough? And he says, that's more than enough because they don't owe me anything.
Huh.
His attitude always has been, nobody owes me anything. So I'm going to, I have this idea. I want to do this thing. I'm going to find a way to do the thing. And if I can get people to come and listen and pay, fantastic, but I need to do the thing. And that's the attitude that, you know, Sorey and Halverson and Bynum and a bunch of other people have taken away from his teaching and from, in many cases, working with him, is this idea that the music exists for itself. So, you know, get it done. Don't worry about whether the world is ready for it.
You talk about these artists that we've been talking about, like Mary Halverson, that they exhibit a particular, this is a quote from the book, a particular sort of relaxed, cool performance of self. Can you elaborate on that?
It's kind of a comfortable middle ground, because there are jazz artists who are more performance oriented.
Right.
In the sense that they are there to entertain you. I mean, I interviewed Branford Marsalis once, and he said, you know, there's a reason people talk about going to see a band. You know, they want a show. They want to watch something, you know. And there is an element of, there are some jazz performers who, particularly on the fringes, who kind of reject that and kind of, you know, they kind of sit on stage as though they're performing their music in order to perform, you know, that's what they're there for. And if you're there,
cool.
As well. But they're, you know, they're not really doing a whole lot of outreach.
Well, it's that's interesting.
They're not announcing tunes. They're not, you know, whatever.
That's interesting, because there's an entire chapter, there are five different groups of artists that you talk about, and there's many artists in each of those groups. But one of the, I think it's group number one, are the traditionalists. And these are artists who look back to jazz artists, jazz music of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And as you write in that chapter, they declare themselves to be jazz musicians through their visual presentation. In other words, the way they look on stage, the way they perform themselves, they're going to be easily identified as jazz musicians. And that appeals a lot to existing jazz fans.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. In the first chapter, I talk about J.D. Allen,
yeah,
who
yeah.
is number one, just a phenomenal saxophonist. Anybody listening to this should be listening to him. He's incredible. And he is one of the most, he's a very adventurous guy in terms of what types of music he's willing to experiment with and try, you know, but always within that band of jazz that sounds like jazz, to put it simply. And he dresses the part too. Like, I remember I saw that, him play as part of a group called Ghidra, and I talk about this in the book, where he was with two other saxophonists, Marcus Strickland and Stacy Dillard. And the night they performed, Dillard was dressed in kind of hip-hop fashion, and I feel like I vaguely remember that Marcus might have been wearing, like, overalls and a shirt, you know, and a pullover or something, on stage. But J.D. Allen was up there in a blazer and a tie. And the other two guys had kind of grubby-looking saxophones, and J.D. Allen's saxophone was polished to the point that it glowed. You know, he really... he looked like a jazz musician on that stage, you know, and he really is very, very conscious of that lineage and of that manner of artistic presentation. He takes it very, very seriously.
When talk about an artist, he's not dealt with as a chapter in your book, but he's mentioned Roy Hargrove. And when I think about Roy Hargrove, I think about bridges. He did a lot of bridging of jazz and hip-hop. He had a funk band, RH Factory. He had a member of the Soulquarians. That idea that you're not limited to one kind of music inspires a lot of other of the jazz musicians in this book.
It does. Roy Hargrove was a very important player in the 90s and in the 2000s. He was very important, not just for the music that he made on his own records and then also playing on big hit records. I mean, he was on D'Angelo's Brown Sugar album, you know, as part of the Soulquarians. He played on records by The Roots. You know, he was part of, he played on records by Erykah Badu. He was part of that whole scene. And at the same time, he was as hardcore a bebop player, as you could want. I mean, the only time I ever saw him live was at Sonny Rollins' 80th birthday concert, and he came out and played a couple of tunes with Sonny Rollins. And I mean, if you can hang with Sonny Rollins, then you are for real, you know.
He was the other artist I was listening just before I talked to you. I was listening to Hargrove's Nothing Serious album, and but it's that attitude. I mean, and it predates him. Miles Davis, as you write about in your book, did a fusion of jazz and hip hop in his final album, Doobop. Album was viewed as a failure.
It is. And people who view it as a failure are only half right. My argument is, and, you know, in the era of playlists and stuff like that, this is even easier than it used to be. Pull that album up on Spotify or whatever, take away all the tracks with vocals, and you've got a hell of an EP. The tracks with vocals are bad because the vocals are bad, but the instrumental pieces are shockingly good. So yeah, revisit Doobop, anyone who's listening to this, but only listen to the instrumentals.
Wow. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Phil Freeman, a music journalist specializing in jazz and metal. And we're talking about his book. There is so much in this book. I think every essay could launch 1,000 arguments. Ugly Beauty, Jazz in the 21st Century. I wanted to go back to Mary Halverson because I've just been listening to her for a couple of years now. And she's a member of the collective Thumbscrew. And this idea of these weird collectives that a lot of these artists in is fascinating. And as you write in, for some of these artists, they're performing music they'll never play live. This is all wild studio experimental stuff, and that's okay with them.
Yeah, I think some of them, you know, really do draw a line between stuff that you record and stuff that you play, and, you know, stuff that you record because you're never going to get the chance to play it. I mean, for example, one of the people that I talk about, and Mary is on this record, is Taylor Hope Bynum's Nine Tet. You know, did this album called The Ambiguity Manifesto. And
that's the one I have in my hand right here. I love this album. I love it.
I went to the Jazz Gallery to see them perform because, and Bynum said this from the stage, basically, you're never going to see this again because we're never going to be able to get all nine of these people together in a room again, you know, because they all have very busy schedules and stuff like that. And so what they did was they presented a reworked, you know, some of the music was very much like it was on the album, and other music was radically reworked even from that. So it was very much a one-off kind of special concert, you know.
But it was you're a bit critical of it, too. I mean, you said there was 30 minutes of the sound of two dozen instrumentalists playing at full force. Became simply too much.
Oh, yeah. No, that was the other one.
Okay.
That was the Cecil Taylor show that I went to once at the Knitting Factory. Yeah. Taylor was famous for putting together these large ensembles that never made it into a recording studio. So if you weren't there on the night, that was it. You know. And
so how would you talk about Taylor Hope Bynum's performance? I've never seen him live. The Ambiguity Manifesto is a fascinating. For people who have not listened to this, this has got references to Ursula Le Guin. There's really weird mirror imagery things going on in both the text and in the music. It's a fascinating album.
Yeah, it is. And watching it performed live was also very interesting because the performers. It was very rare that all nine players were playing at once. Usually what would happen would be the group would subdivide into twos or threes, and they would kind of take a melody from the collected sheet music that they had in front of them and work on, you know, like sort of interpret that, like play a brief solo based on that little, you know, sheet music phrase or whatever. And to actually watch it happen was really fascinating because while one group, let's say, you know, Mary Halverson and cellist Tamika Reed and bassist Stomo Takeishi might be doing one thing, you know, and while they were doing that, another player like Taylor Hope Bynum, you know, who was playing the trumpet and cornet, would look across the stage at, let's say, Ingrid Laubrock, the saxophonist, and they would kind of lock eyes, you know, and say,
wow.
And basically silently establish, okay, we're going to work together in a minute when these three are done. And so when those three kind of wound down their thing, Taylor and Laubrock would kind of hold up three fingers, you know, which would say, okay, we're going to do part three, you know, and they would start playing, you know, from part three of the score. And so, and then, you know, another group would do something, you know, the bassist and drummer might do something or the pianist, you know, it was really fascinating to watch everybody kind of figure out, okay, who's going to go next and what are they going to do and make it flow naturally from one thing to the, you know, from one thing to the next. It was a very organic process and very interesting to watch and hear.
One of the things that my feeling is listening to this album is it demands attention. You can't like put it on in the background like you can some jazz albums and just do your housework. It's not that kind of music.
No, it's not. And a lot of the music that I deal with in the book is of that sort of, particularly in that section where I deal with, you know, Taylor and with Mary and with Vijay Iyer and a few other people. That is music that has a certain rigor to it and demands careful listening. And it demands, in some cases, it demands repeated listening to allow it to kind of sink into your mind. You know, it's, I guess I would compare it to watching a movie where a lot of clues are dropped and it takes maybe two or three viewings to sort of piece it all together. You know, you're not gonna understand everything that happened on the first go round. And you have to be up for that challenge.
I just want to mention one line that I don't know why this struck me, but you can get rather technical in your book too. You talk about Mary Halverson's Line 6 DL4 delay pedal that she's known for. Can you explain? I'm not a musician, so I don't know what that means. Can you explain that?
Nor am I, and she explained it very carefully to me, because I said, you know, what's this squiggly noise? And she says, okay, that's this particular pedal, and here's what it's called, and here's how it works. And basically what it is when you listen to Mary's guitar playing, very often she'll be playing like a very fast string of notes, and then all of a sudden you'll hear this noise, like a squiggly unwinding ribbon noise, almost as though like you were listening to a cassette and it came spewing out of the player.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah, I know that.
But she gets it under control really fast. It only happens for a second or two. And that's because she has this pedal that she's figured out, you know, how to like step on the pedal and then step off of it again for like 1 or 2 seconds at a time. And it just creates this weird disorienting little noise that kind of punctuates whatever she's playing. And it's very funny because when I spoke to her about it, it really is a trademark of hers.
Yeah, yeah.
You listen to her records and you're immediately, like if you've heard her records, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yep.
And she said to me that it was very funny that it became her trademark because she says, you know, it's not a rare or hard to find pedal. And it's like, it's super easy to do this. I don't know why I'm the only one that ever picked up on this trick.
Wild. But she, like, did she talk about the first time she did it? Like, did she knew that this is something I want to incorporate in my music?
I guess it's the kind of thing that when you stumble across it, it sort of becomes an epiphany. Like, wow. I can really make something out of this, you know?
We're completely out of time, and I haven't even gotten to, like, a whole other sections of your book, but that's okay. People need to read it. My guest tonight has been Phil Freeman, a music journalist specializing in jazz and metal, and we've been talking about his book, Ugly Beauty, Jazz in the 21st Century. Phil, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.